Spoiled, immature, badly educated, and lacking basic management skills, Troy Jr. had run roughshod through an entire division in minerals before Solomon was given the green light from above to sack him. A few years later, a similar episode involved Rex and his pursuit of his father's approval and money. In the end, Rex had gone to Troy in an effort to remove Solomon. The wives and other children had butted in for years, but Troy had held fast. His private life was a fiasco, but nothing hampered his beloved company. Solomon and Troy had never been close. In fact, no one, perhaps with the exception of Josh Stafford, had ever managed to become a confidant. The parade of blondes had shared the obvious intimacies, but Troy had no friends. And as he withdrew and declined, both physically and mentally, those who ran the company sometimes whispered about its ownership. Surely Troy would not leave it to his children. He hadn't, at least not the usual suspects. The board was waiting on the 14th floor in the same conference room where Troy had produced his testament, then taken flight. Solomon described the scene in the courtroom, and his colorful narrative became humorous. Thoughts of the heirs gaining control had caused great discomfort among the board. Troy Jr. had let it be known that he and his siblings had the votes to seize a majority, and that he planned to clean house and show some real profits. They wanted to know about Janie, wife number two. She'd worked for the company as a secretary until her promotion to mistress, then to wife, and after reaching the top she had been particularly abusive to many of the employees. Troy banned her from the corporate headquarters. "When she left, she was crying," Solomon said happily. "And Rex?" asked a director, the chief financial officer, who had once been fired by Rex in an elevator. "Not a happy boy. He's under investigation, you know." They talked about most of the children and all of the wives, and the meeting grew festive. "I counted 22 lawyers," Solomon said with a smile. "Talk about a sad bunch." Since it was an informal board meeting, Josh's absence was of no consequence. The head of legal declared the will to be a stroke of great luck after all. They had to worry about only one unknown heir, as opposed to six idiots. "Any idea where this woman is?" "None," answered Solomon. "Maybe Josh knows." By late afternoon, Josh had been forced from his office and had retreated to a small library in the basement of his building. His secretary stopped counting phone messages at 120. The lobby off the main entrance had been crammed with reporters since late morning. He'd left behind strict instructions with his secretaries that no one should disturb him for an hour. So the knock on the door was especially aggravating. "Who is it?" he shot at the door.
"It's an emergency, sir," answered a secretary.
"Come in." Her head entered just far enough to look him in the face and say,
"It's Mr. O'Reilly."
Josh stopped rubbing his temples and actually smiled. He glanced around the room and remembered there were no phones. She took two steps and placed a portable on the table, then disappeared. "Nate," he said into the receiver. "That you, Josh?" came the reply. The volume was fine, but the words were a little scratchy. The reception was better than most car phones. "Yes, can you hear me, Nate?"
"Yes."
"Where are you?"
"I'm on the satellite on the back of my little yacht, floating down the Paraguay River. Can you hear me?"
"Yes, fine. Are you okay, Nate?"
"I'm wonderful, having a ball. Just a little boat trouble."
"What kind of trouble?"
"Well, the propeller snagged a line of old rope and the engine choked down. My crew is attempting to unravel it. I'm supervising."
"You sound great. It's an adventure, right, Josh?"
"Of course.
Any sign of the girl?"
"Not a chance. We're a couple of days away at best, and now we're floating backward. I'm not sure we'll ever get there."
"You have to, Nate. We read the will this morning in open court. The whole world will soon be looking for Rachel Lane."
"I wouldn't worry about that. She's safe."
"I wish I were with you."
The edge of a cloud nipped the signal.
"What did you say?"
Nate asked, louder.
Nothing. So you'll see her in a couple of days, huh?
If we're lucky. The boat runs around the clock, but we're going upriver, and it's the rainy season. So the rivers are full, and the currents are strong. Plus, we're not exactly sure where we're going. 2 days is very optimistic, assuming we get the damn propeller fixed.
So the weather's bad, Josh said, almost at random. There wasn't much to discuss. Nate was alive and well and moving in the general direction of the target.
It's hot as hell, and it rains 5 times a day. Other than that, it's lovely.
Any snakes?
A couple. Anacondas, longer than the boat. Lots of alligators. Rats as big as dogs. They call them capybaras. They live at the edge of the rivers among the alligators, and when these people get hungry enough, they kill them and eat them.
But you have plenty of food.
Oh, yes. Our cargo is black beans and rice. Welly cooks them for me 3 times a day.
Nate's voice was sharp and filled with adventure.
Who's Welly?
My deckhand. Right now he's under the boat in 12 feet of water, holding his breath and cutting rope from the prop. Like I said, I'm supervising.
Stay out of the water, Nate.
Are you kidding? I'm on the upper deck.
Look, I gotta run. I'm using juice and I haven't found a way to recharge these batteries.
When will you call again?
I'll try and wait until after I find Rachel Lane.
Good idea. But call if you have trouble.
Trouble? Why would I call you, Josh? There's not a damn thing in the world you can do.
You're right. Don't call.
Chapter 20. The storm hit at dusk, as Welly was boiling rice in the kitchen and Jevy was watching the river grow dark. The wind woke Nate, a sudden howling blast that shook the hammock and snapped him to his feet. Thunder and lightning followed. He walked to Jevy's side and looked north into a vast blackness.
"A big storm," Jevy said, seemingly indifferent.
"Shouldn't we park this thing?" Nate thought. "At least find shallow water."
Jevy didn't appear concerned. His nonchalance was somewhat comforting.
When the rain started, Nate went below for his rice and beans. He ate in silence, with Welly in the corner of the cabin. The bulb above them swayed as the wind rocked the boat. Heavy raindrops battered the windows. On the bridge, Jevy put on a yellow poncho stained with grease and fought the rain hitting him sharply in the face. The tiny wheelhouse had no windows. The 2 floodlights attempted to show the way through the darkness, but revealed no more than 50 feet of churning water in front of them. Jevy knew the river well, and he'd been through worse storms. Reading was difficult with the boat swaying and rolling. After a few minutes of it, Nate felt sick. In his bag he found a knee-length poncho with a hood. Josh had thought of everything. Clutching the railings, he slowly made his way up the stairs, where Welly sat huddled next to the wheelhouse, drenched. The river bent to the east, toward the heart of the Pantanal, and when they turned, the wind caught them broadside. The boat rocked and threw Nate and Welly hard into the railings. Jevy braced himself with the door of the wheelhouse, his thick arms holding himself in place and maintaining control. The gusts became relentless, one after the other, only seconds apart, and the Santa Laura stopped moving upstream. The storm shoved it toward shore. The rain pellets were hard and cold now, and poured down upon them in sheets. Jevy found a long flashlight in a box beside the wheel and gave it to Welly. "Find the bank!" he yelled, his voice struggling over the howling wind and heavy rain.
Nate grappled along the railings to a spot next to Welly because he too wanted to see where they might be headed. But the beam caught nothing but rain, rain so thick it looked like fog swirling above the water. Then lightning came to their aid. A flash, and they saw the dense black growth of the riverbank not far away. The wind was pushing them toward it. Welly shouted and Jevy yelled something back just as another gust slammed into the boat and tipped it violently to its starboard side. The sudden jolt knocked the flashlight out of Welly's hand, and they watched it disappear into the water. Crouched on the walkway, clutching the railing, soaked and shivering, it occurred to Nate that one of two things was about to happen, and neither was within their control. First, the boat was going to capsize.
If it didn't, then they were about to be shoved into the side of the river, into the quagmire where the reptiles lived. He was only slightly scared until he thought about the papers. Under no circumstances could the papers be lost. He suddenly stood just as the boat tipped again, and he almost went over the rail. "I have to go below!" he yelled to Chevy, who was gripping the wheel. The captain was scared, too. With his back to the wind, Nate crept down the grated steps. The deck was slick with diesel fuel. A drum had tipped over and was leaking. He tried to lift it, but it would take two men. He ducked into the cabin, flung his poncho in a corner, and went for his briefcase under the cot. The wind slammed into the boat. It pitched and caught Nate with his hands free. He landed hard against the wall with his feet above his head. There were two things he couldn't lose, he decided. First, the papers. Second, the sat phone. Both were in the briefcase, which was new and nice, but certainly not waterproof. He clutched it across his chest and lay on his bunk while the Santa Laura rode out the storm. The knocking stopped. He hoped Chevy had killed the engine with a switch. He could hear their footsteps directly above him. "We're about to hit the bank," he thought, "and it's best for the prop to be disengaged. Surely it wasn't engine trouble." The lights went out. Complete darkness. Lying there in the dark, swaying with the pitch and roll, waiting for the Santa Laura to crash into the riverbank, Nate had a horrible thought. If she refused to sign the acknowledgement and or the waiver, a return trip might be necessary. Months down the road, or maybe years, someone, probably Nate himself, would be forced to trek back up the Paraguay and inform the world's richest missionary that things were finalized and the money was hers. He had read that missionaries took furloughs, long breaks in their work when they returned to the States and recharged their batteries. Why couldn't Rachel take a furlough? Maybe even fly home with him, and hang around long enough for Daddy's mess to get cleaned up. For $11 billion, that seemed the least she could do. He'd suggest it to her, if he ever got the chance to meet her. There was a crash, and Nate was tossed to the floor. They were in the brush. The Santa Laura was flat-bottomed, built, like all the boats in the Pantanal, to scrape across sandbars and take the hits of river debris. After the storm, Chevy started the engine and for half an hour worked the boat back and forth, slowly dislodging it from the sand and mud. When they were free, Welly and Nate cleared the deck of limbs and brush. Their search of the boat found no new passengers, no snakes or jacarés. During a quick coffee break, Chevy told the story of an anaconda that had found its way on board years ago, attacked a sleeping deckhand. Nate said he didn't particularly care for snake stories. His search was slow and deliberate. The clouds went away and a beautiful half-moon appeared above the river. Welly brewed a pot of coffee. After the violence of the storm, the Pantanal seemed determined to be perfectly still. The river was as smooth as glass. The moon guided them, disappearing when they turned with the river, but always there when they headed north again. Because Nate was half Brazilian now, he wore no wristwatch. Time mattered little. It was late, probably midnight. The rain had battered them for 4 hours. Nate slept a few hours in the hammock and awakened just after dawn. He found Chevy snoring on his bunk in the tiny cabin behind the wheelhouse. Welly was at the wheel, himself half asleep. Nate sent him for coffee and took the helm of the Santa Laura. The clouds were back, but no rain was in sight. The river was littered with limbs and leaves, the rubble and remains from last night's storm. It was wide, and there was no traffic, so Nate the skipper sent Welly to the hammock for a nap while he commanded the vessel. It beat the hell out of a courtroom. Shirtless, shoeless, sipping sweet coffee while leading an expedition into the heart of the world's largest swamp. In the glory days, he would have been racing to a trial somewhere, juggling 10 things at once, phones stuck in every pocket. He didn't really miss it. No lawyer in his right mind really missed the courtroom, but he would never admit that. The boat practically guided itself. With Jevy's binoculars, he watched the shoreline for jacarés, snakes, and capivaras. And he counted to Iuius, the tall, white, long-necked bird with a red head that had become the symbol of the Pantanal. There were 12 in one flock on a sandbar. They stood still and watched the boat go by. The captain and his sleepy crew steamed northward as the sky turned orange and the day began. Deeper and deeper into the Pantanal, uncertain where their journey would lead them. Chapter 21. The coordinator of South American missions was a woman named Neva Collier. She was born in an igloo in Newfoundland, where her parents had worked for 20 years among the Inuit natives. She herself had spent 11 years working in the mountains of New Guinea, so she knew firsthand the trials and challenges of the 900 or so people whose activity she coordinated. And she was the only person who knew that Rachel Porter had once been Rachel Lane, illegitimate daughter of Troy Phelan. After med school, Rachel had changed names in an effort to erase as much of her past as possible. She had no family. Both adoptive parents had died. No siblings, no aunts, uncles, or cousins, at least none that she knew. She had only Troy, and she was desperate to remove him from her life. After completing the World Tribe Seminary, Rachel had confided her secrets to Neva Collier. The higher-ups at World Tribes knew Rachel had secrets, but not a history that would impede her yearning to serve God. She was a doctor, a graduate of their seminary, a dedicated and humble servant of Christ, who was eager to enter the mission field. They promised never to divulge anything about Rachel, including her exact location in South America. Sitting in her small, neat office in Houston, Neva read the extraordinary account of the reading of Mr. Phelan's will. She had been following the story since the suicide. Communication with Rachel was a slow process. They exchanged mail twice a year, in March and in August, and Rachel usually called once a year from a payphone in Corumbá when she went there for supplies. Neva had spoken to her the year before. Her last furlough had been in 1992. After 6 weeks, she'd abandoned it and returned to the Pantanal. She had no interest in being in the U.S., she had confided in Neva. It was not her home. She belonged with her people. Judging from the lawyer's comments in the article, the issue was far from settled. Neva put the file away and decided to wait. At the appropriate time, whenever that might be, she would inform her governing board of Rachel's old identity. She hoped that moment would never come. But how exactly does one hide $11 billion? No one really expected the lawyers to agree on where to meet. Each firm insisted on choosing the site of the summit. The fact that they agreed to actually get together on such short notice was monumental. So they met at a hotel, the Ritz in Tyson's Corner, in a banquet room where tables had been hastily wedged together in a perfect square. When the door was finally closed, there were close to 50 people in the room, for every firm felt obliged to bring along extra associates and paralegals and even secretaries to impress. The tension was almost visible. No Phelans were present, only their legal teams. Hart Geddes called the meeting to order and did the wise thing of cracking a very funny joke. Like humor in the courtroom, where people were anxious and not expecting comedy, the laughter was loud and healthy. He suggested they go around the table and let one lawyer per Phelan heir say what was on his or her mind. He would go last. An objection was lodged. Who exactly are the heirs? The 6 Phelan children, Hark responded. What about the 3 wives? They're not heirs, they're ex-wives.
This upset the attorneys for the wives, and after a heated battle, they threatened to walk out. Someone suggested allowing them to speak anyway, and this solved the problem.
Grit, the feisty litigator hired by Mary Ross Phelan Jackman and her husband, stood and made a plea for war.
"We have no choice but to challenge the will," he said. "There was no undue influence, so we have to prove the old buzzard was crazy. Hell, he jumped to his death, and he gave one of the world's great fortunes to some unknown heir. Sounds crazy to me. We can find psychiatrists who'll testify."
"What about the three who examined him before he jumped?" someone shot from across the table.
"That was stupid," Grit snarled back. "It was a setup, and you guys fell for it."
This upset Hark and the other lawyers who had agreed on the mental exam.
"Perfect hindsight," Yancey said, and that stalled Grit for the moment.
The legal team for Gina and Cody Strong was headed by a woman named Langhorne, who was tall and thick and wore an Armani dress. She had once been a professor at Georgetown Law, and when she addressed the group, she did so with the air of one who knew everything. Point one. There were only two grounds for contesting a will in Virginia, undue influence and lack of mental capacity. Since no one knew Rachel Lane, it was safe to assume she had little or no contact with Troy. Therefore, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to prove she somehow unduly influenced him when he made his last will. Point two. Lack of testamentary capacity was their only hope. Point three. Forget fraud. Sure, he lured them into the mental exam under false pretenses, but a will cannot be attacked on the grounds of fraud. A contract, yes, a will, no. They had already done the research, and she had the cases if anyone cared. She worked from a brief of some sort and was impeccably prepared. No less than six others from her firm huddled behind her in support. Point four, the mental exam would be very difficult to crack. She'd seen the video. They would probably lose the war, but they could get paid for the battle. Her conclusion? Challenge the will with a fury and hope for a lucrative out-of-court settlement. Her lecture lasted for 10 minutes and covered little new ground. She was tolerated without interruption because she was female and the chip was almost visible. Wally Bright, he of the night school, was next, and in sharp contrast to Ms. Langhorne, he raged and railed at injustice in general. Nothing was prepared. No brief, no notes, no thoughts about what he would say next. Just a lot of hot air by a lawyer who perpetually flew by the seat of his pants. Two of Lillian's lawyers stood at the same time and appeared to be joined at the hip. Both wore black suits and had the pale faces of estate lawyers who rarely saw the sun. One would start a sentence, and the other would finish it. One would ask a rhetorical question, the other had the answer. One mentioned a file, the other pulled it from a briefcase. The tag team was efficient, to the point, and repeated in succinct fashion what had already been said. A consensus was quickly emerging. Fight, for A, there was little to lose, B, there was nothing else to do, and C, it was the only way to force a settlement. Not to mention D, wherein they would get paid handsomely by the hour for fighting. Yancey was particularly forceful in urging the use of litigation. And rightly so. Ramble was the only minor among the heirs, and had no debts to speak of. The trust that would pay him $5 million on his 21st had been established decades earlier and could not be revoked. With $5 million guaranteed, Ramble was in far better shape financially than any of his siblings. With nothing to lose, why not sue for more? An hour passed before someone mentioned the contest clause in the will. The heirs, excluding Ramble, ran the risk of losing what little Troy left them if they contested the will. This issue was given slight treatment by the lawyers. They had already decided to fight the will, and they knew their greedy clients would follow their advice. A lot was not being said. The litigation would be cumbersome to begin with. The wisest and most cost-efficient course would be to select one firm with experience to act as chief trial counsel. The others could take a step back, still protect their clients, and be kept abreast of every development. Such a strategy would require two things. One, cooperation, and two, the voluntary downsizing of most of the egos in the room. It was never mentioned during the 3-hour meeting. Through no grand scheme of their own, schemes require cooperation, the lawyers had managed to divide the heirs so that no two shared the same firm. Through skillful manipulation that is not taught in law school but acquired naturally thereafter, the lawyers had convinced the clients to spend more time talking to them than to their fellow heirs. Trust was not a virtue known to the Phelans, nor to their attorneys. It was shaping up to be one long, chaotic lawsuit. Not one brave voice suggested the will be left alone. There was not the slightest interest in following the wishes of the man who'd actually made the fortune they now conspired to carve up. During the 3rd or 4th trip around the tables, an effort was made to determine the level of debt held by each of the 6 heirs at the time of Mr. Phelan's death, but the effort fizzled under a barrage of legal nitpicking. "Are the debts of spouses included?" asked Hark, attorney for Rex, whose wife Amber the stripper owned the skin clubs and had her name on most of the debts. "What about obligations to the IRS?" asked the attorney for Troy Jr., who had been having tax trouble for 15 years. "My clients have not authorized me to divulge financial information," said Langhorne, who with that dire declaration effectively iced the issue. The reluctance confirmed what everybody knew. The Phelan heirs were up to their ears in loans and mortgages. All the lawyers, being lawyers, were deeply concerned about publicity and how their fight would be portrayed by the media. Their clients were not simply a bunch of spoiled, greedy children who'd been cut out by their father, but they feared the press might take this posture. Perceptions were crucial. "I suggest we hire a public relations firm," Hark announced. It was a wonderful idea, one that several others immediately seized as their own. Hire a pro to paint the Phelan heirs as the broken-hearted children who'd loved a man who had little time for them. An eccentric, philandering, half-crazy, yes, that was it, make Troy the bad guy, and make their clients the victims. The idea bloomed, and the fiction spread happily around the tables, until someone asked just exactly how they would pay for such services. "They're horribly expensive," said a lawyer, who happened to be charging $600 an hour for himself and $400 an hour for each of his 3 useless associates. The idea lost steam quickly, until Hark offered the lame suggestion that each firm could front some expense money. The meeting grew incredibly quiet. Those who'd had so much to say about everything were now captivated by the magical language of briefs and old cases. "We can talk about this later," Hark said, attempting to save face. No doubt the idea would never be mentioned again. They then discussed Rachel and where she might be. Should they retain a top-notch security firm to locate her? Almost every lawyer happened to know one. The idea was quite appealing and received more attention than it should have. What lawyer wouldn't want to represent the chosen heir? But they decided against looking for Rachel, primarily because they couldn't agree on what they would do if they found her. She would surface soon enough, no doubt with her own entourage of lawyers. The meeting ended on a pleasant note. The lawyers gave themselves the outcome they wanted. They left with plans to immediately call their clients and proudly report how much progress was made. They could say unequivocally that it was the combined wisdom of all the Phelan lawyers that the will should be attacked with a vengeance. Chapter 22. The river rose throughout the day, slowly leaving its banks in some places, swallowing sandbars, rising into the thick brush, flooding the small, muddy yards of houses they passed once every 3 hours. The river carried more and more debris, weeds and grass, limbs and saplings. As it grew wider, it grew stronger, and the currents running against the boat slowed them even more. But no one was watching the clock.
Nate had been politely relieved of his captain's duties after the Santa Laura was struck by a wayward tree trunk, one he never saw. No damage, but the jolt sent Chevy and Welly scurrying to the wheelhouse. He returned to his own little deck, with a hammock stretched through the center, and there he spent the morning reading and watching wildlife. Chevy joined him for coffee. "So what do you think of the Pantanal?" he asked. They sat next to each other, on a bench, with their arms through the railing and their bare feet dangling over the side of the boat. "It's pretty magnificent. Do you know Colorado?"
"I've been there, yes."
"During the rainy season, the rivers in the Pantanal overflow. The flooded area is the size of Colorado."
"Have you been to Colorado?"
"Yes, I have a cousin there."
"Where else have you been?"
3 years ago, my cousin and I rode a big bus, a Greyhound, across the country. We were in every state but six."
Chevy was a poor Brazilian boy of 24. Nate was twice his age and for most of his career had had plenty of money. Yet Chevy had seen much more of the U.S. than Nate. When the money was good, though, Nate had always traveled to Europe. His favorite restaurants were in Rome and Paris.
"When the floods stop," Chevy continued, "we have the dry season. Grasslands, marshes, more lagoons and swamps than anyone can count. The cycle, the flooding, and the dry season produces more wildlife than any place in the world. We have 650 species of birds here, more than Canada and the U.S. combined. At least 260 species of fish, snakes, caiman, alligators, even giant otters live in the water."
As if on cue, he pointed to a thicket at the edge of a small forest.
"Look, it's a deer," he said. "We have lots of deer, and lots of jaguars, giant anteaters, capybaras, tapirs, and macaws. The Pantanal is filled with wildlife."
"You were born here?"
"I took my first breath in the hospital in Corumbá, but I was born on these rivers. This is my home."
"You told me your father was a river pilot."
"Yes. When I was a small boy, I began going with him. Early in the morning, when everybody was asleep, he would allow me to take the wheel. I knew all the main rivers by the time I was 10.
"And he died on the river?"
"Not this, but the Taquari, to the east. He was guiding a boat of German tourists when a storm hit them. The only survivor was a deckhand."
"When was this?"
5 years ago."
Forever the trial lawyer, Nate had a dozen more questions about the accident. He wanted the details. Details win lawsuits. But he said,
"I'm sorry," and let it go.
"They want to destroy the Pantanal," Chevy said.
"Who?"
"Lots of people. Big companies that own big farms. To the north and east of the Pantanal, they are clearing large sections of land for farms. The main crop is soja, which you call soybeans. They want to export it. The more forests they clear, the more runoff collects in the Pantanal. Sediment rises each year in our rivers. Their farm soil is not good, so the companies use many sprays and fertilizers to grow crops. We get the chemicals. Many of the big farms dam up rivers to create new pastures. This upsets the flooding cycle. And mercury is killing our fish."
"How does mercury get here?"
"Mining. To the north, they mine gold, and they do it with mercury. It runs into the rivers eventually run into the Pantanal. Our fish swallow it and die. Everything is dumped into the Pantanal. Cuiabá is a city of 1 million people to the east. It has no waste treatment. Guess where its sewage goes?"
"Doesn't the government help?"
Chevy managed a bitter laugh.
"Have you heard of Hidrovia?"
"No."
"It's a big ditch to be cut through the Pantanal. It's supposed to link Brazil, Bolivia, Paraguay, Argentina, and Uruguay. It is supposed to save South America, but it will drain the Pantanal, and our government is supporting it."
Nate almost said something pious about environmental responsibility, then remembered that his countrymen were the biggest energy hogs the world had ever seen.
"It's still beautiful," he said.
"It is."
Chevy finished his coffee.
"Sometimes I think it's too big for them to destroy." They passed a narrow inlet where more water entered the Paraguay. A small herd of deer waded through the floodwaters, nibbling at green vines, oblivious to the noise from the river. 7 deer, 2 of which were spotted fawns.
"There is a small trading post a few hours away," Chevy said, getting to his feet. "We should be there before dark."
"What are we shopping for?"
"Nothing, I guess. Fernando is the owner, and he hears everything on the river. Maybe he will know something about missionaries."
Chevy emptied his cup into the river and stretched his arms.
"Sometimes he has beer for sale. Cerveja."
Nate kept his eyes on the water.
"I think we should not buy any," Chevy said, and walked away.
"Fine with me," thought Nate. He drained his cup, sucking down the grounds and grains of sugar. A cold brown bottle. Perhaps Antarctica or Brahma, the 2 brands he'd already sampled in Brazil. Excellent beer. A favorite haunt had been a college bar near Georgetown with 120 foreign beers on the menu. He'd tried them all. They served roasted peanuts by the basket and expected you to throw the hulls on the floor. When his pals from law school were in town, they always met at the bar and reminisced about the old days. The beer was ice cold, the peanuts hot and salty, the floor cracked with hulls when you walked, and the girls were young and loose. The place had been there forever, and during each trip through rehab and sobriety, it was the bar Nate missed most. He began to sweat, though the sun was hidden and there was a cool breeze. He buried himself in the hammock and prayed for sleep, a deep, hard coma that would take him past their little stop and into the night. The sweating worsened until his shirt was soaked. He started a book about the demise of the Brazilian Indians, then tried to sleep again. He was wide awake when the engine was throttled down and the boat moved close to the bank. There were voices, then a gentle bump as they docked at the trading post. Nate slowly removed himself from the hammock and returned to the bench where he sat. It was a country store of sorts, built on stilts, a tiny building made of unpainted boards with a tin roof and a narrow porch where, not surprisingly, a couple of locals were lounging with cigarettes and tea. A smaller river circled behind it and disappeared into the Pantanal. A large fuel tank was braced to the side of the building. A flimsy pier jutted into the river to dock the boats. Chevy and Welly eased along the pier carefully because the currents were strong. They chatted with the Pantaneiros on the porch, then went through the open door. Nate had vowed to remain on the boat. He went to the other side of the deck, sat on the opposite bench, stuck his arms and legs through the rail, and watched the full width of the river go by. He would stay up on the deck, on the bench, with his arms and legs locked in the rail. The coldest beer in the world couldn't pull him away. As he had learned, there was no such thing as a short visit in Brazil, especially on the river, where visits were rare. Chevy bought 30 gallons of diesel fuel to replace what had been lost in the storm. The engine started.
"Fernando says there is a woman missionary. She works with the Indians."
Chevy handed him a bottle of cold water. They were moving again.
"Where?" "He's not sure. There are some settlements to the north, near Bolivia. But the Indians don't move on the river, so he doesn't know much about them."
"How far is the nearest settlement?"
"We should be close by morning, but we can't take this boat. We must use the little one."
"Sounds like fun."
"You remember Marco, the farmer whose cow was killed by our plane?"
"Sure I do. He had 3 little boys."
"Yes, he was there yesterday," Chevy
said, pointing to the store, which was disappearing around a bend.
"He comes once a month."
"Were the boys with him?"
"No, he's too dangerous."
What a small world. Nate hoped the boys had spent the money he'd given them for Christmas. He watched the store until it was out of sight. Perhaps on the return leg he'd be well enough to stop and have a cool one. Just a couple, to celebrate their successful journey. He crawled back into the safety of his hammock,
and cursed himself for his weakness. In the wilderness of a gigantic swamp, he'd had a near brush with alcohol, and for hours his thoughts had been consumed with nothing else. The anticipation, the fear, the sweating, and the scheming of ways to get a drink. Then the near miss, the escape through no strength of his own, and now, in the aftermath, the fantasy of renewing his romance with alcohol. A few drinks would be fine, because then he could stop. That was his favorite lie. He was just a drunk. Run him through a designer rehab clinic at $1,000 a day, and he was still an addict. Run him through AA in the basement of a church on Tuesday nights, and he was still a drunk. His addictions gripped him, and desperation settled around Nate. He was paying for the damned boat. Chevy worked for him. If he insisted that they turn around and go straight to the store, they would do so. He could buy all the beer Fernando owned, load it on ice below the deck, and sip Brahma all the way to Bolivia. And there wasn't a damned thing anyone could do about it. Like a mirage, Welly appeared with a smile and a cup of fresh coffee. "Vou cozinhar," he said. "I'm going to cook." Food would help, Nate thought. Even another platter of beans, rice, and boiled chicken. Food would satisfy his tastes, or at least divert his attention from other cravings. He ate slowly on the upper deck, alone and in the dark, swatting thick mosquitoes away from his face. When he was finished, he sprayed repellent from his neck to his bare feet. The seizure was over. Only slight aftershocks gripped him. He could no longer taste beer or smell the peanuts from his favorite bar. He retreated to his sanctuary. It was raining again, a quiet rain with no wind or thunder. Josh had sent along 4 books for his reading pleasure. All the briefs and memos had been read and reread. Nothing remained but the books. He'd already read half of the thinnest one. He burrowed deep in the hammock and went back to reading the sad history of the native people of Brazil. When the Portuguese explorer Pedro Álvares Cabral first stepped on Brazilian soil on the coast of Bahia in April of 1500, the country had 5 million Indians scattered among 900 tribes. They spoke 1,175 languages, and except for the usual tribal skirmish, they were peaceful people. After centuries of getting themselves civilized by Europeans, the Indian population had been decimated. Only 270,000 survived, in 206 tribes using 170 languages. War, murder, slavery, territorial losses, diseases. No method of exterminating Indians had been neglected by those from civilized cultures. It was a sick and violent history. If the Indians were peaceful and tried to cooperate with the colonists, they were subject to strange diseases, smallpox, measles, yellow fever, influenza, tuberculosis, for which they had no natural defenses. If they did not cooperate, they were slaughtered by men using weapons more sophisticated than arrows and poisoned darts. When they fought back and killed their attackers, they were branded as savages. They were enslaved by miners, ranchers, and rubber barons. They were driven from their ancestral homes by any group with enough guns. They were burned at the stake by priests, hunted by armies and gangs of bandits, raped at will by any able-bodied man with a desire, and slaughtered with impunity. At every point in history, whether crucial or insignificant, when the interests of native Brazilians conflicted with those of white people, the Indians had lost. You lose for 500 years, and you expect little from life. The biggest problem facing some modern-day tribes was the suicide of its young people. After 450 years of genocide, the Brazilian government finally decided it was time to protect its noble savages. Modern-day massacres had brought international condemnation, so bureaucracies were established and laws were passed.
With self-righteous fanfare, some tribal lands were returned to the natives, and lines were drawn on government maps, declaring them to be safe zones. But the government was also the enemy. In 1967, an investigation into the agency in charge of Indian Affairs shocked most Brazilians. The report revealed that agents, land speculators, and ranchers, thugs who either worked for the agency or had the agency working for them, had been systematically using chemical and bacteriological weapons to wipe out Indians. They issued clothing to the Indians that was infected with smallpox and tuberculosis germs. With airplanes and helicopters, they bombed Indian villages and land with deadly bacteria. And in the Amazon basin and other frontiers, ranchers and miners cared little for lines on maps. In 1986, a rancher in Rondônia used crop dusters to spray nearby Indian land with deadly chemicals. He wanted to farm the land, but first had to eliminate the inhabitants. 30 Indians died, and the rancher was never prosecuted. In 1989, a rancher in Mato Grosso offered rewards to bounty hunters for the ears of murdered Indians. In 1993, gold miners in Manaus attacked a peaceful tribe because they would not leave their land. 13 Indians were murdered, and no one was ever arrested. In the 1990s, the government had aggressively sought to open up the Amazon basin, a land of vast natural resources to the north of the Pantanal. But the Indians were still in the way. The majority of those surviving inhabited the basin. In fact, it was estimated that as many as 50 jungle tribes had been lucky enough to escape contact with civilization. Now, civilization was on the attack again. The abuse of Indians was growing as miners and loggers and ranchers pushed deep into the Amazon with the support of the government. The history was fascinating, if depressing. Nate read for 4 hours nonstop and finished the book. He walked to the wheelhouse and drank coffee with Jevy. The rain had stopped. "Will we be there by morning?" he asked. "I think so." The lights from the boat rocked gently up and down with the current. It seemed as though they were hardly moving. "Do you have any Indian blood?" Nate asked after some hesitation. It was a personal matter, one that in the U.S. no one would dare ask. Jevy smiled without taking his gaze from the river. "All of us have Indian blood. Why do you ask?" "I've been reading the history of Indians in Brazil." "So what do you think?" "It's pretty tragic." "It is. Do you think the Indians have been treated badly here?" "Of course they have." "What about in your country?" For some reason, General Custer was the first thought. At least the Indians had won something. "And we didn't burn them at the stake, or spray them with chemicals, or sell them into slavery." "Did we? What about all those reservations? Land everywhere?" "Not much better, I'm afraid," he said in defeat. It was not a discussion he wanted. After a long silence, Nate eased down to the toilet. When he finished his work there, he pulled the chain above it and left the small room. Light brown river water ran into the toilet bowl and flushed the waste through a tube and sent it directly into the river. Chapter 23. It was still dark when the engine stopped and woke Nate. He touched his left wrist and remembered he wasn't wearing a watch. He listened as Welly and Jevy moved below him. They were at the rear of the boat, talking quietly. He was proud of himself for another sober morning, another clean day for the books. 6 months earlier, every wake-up had been a blur of swollen eyes, cobwebbed thoughts, seared mouth, arid tongue, bitter breath, and the great daily question of, why did I do it? He often vomited in the shower, sometimes inducing it himself to get it over with. After the shower, there was always the dilemma of what to have for breakfast, something warm and oily to settle the stomach, or perhaps a Bloody Mary to settle the nerves. Then he was off to work, always at his desk by 8, to begin another brutal day as a litigator. Every morning, no exceptions. In the final days of his last crash, he had gone weeks without a clear morning. Out of desperation, he'd seen a counselor, and when asked if he could recall the last day he'd stayed sober, he admitted he could not. He missed the drinking, but not the hangovers. Well, he pulled the John boat to the port side of the Santa Laura and tied it closely. They were loading it when Nate crept down the steps. The adventure was moving into a new phase. Nate was ready for a change of scenery. It was overcast and threatening more rain. The sun finally broke through at about 6. Nate knew because he'd rearmed himself with a watch. A rooster crowed. They were docked near a small farmhouse, their bow tied to a timber that once held a pier. Westward, to their left, a much smaller river met the Paraguay. The challenge was to pack the boat without overloading it. The smaller tributaries they were about to encounter were flooded. Banks would not always be visible. If the boat sat too low in the water, they might run aground, or worse, damage the prop of the outboard. There was only one motor on the John boat, no backup, just a couple of paddles that Nate studied from the deck as he drank his coffee. The paddles would work, he decided, especially if wild Indians or hungry animals were in pursuit. 3 5-gallon gas tanks were arranged neatly in the center of the boat. "These should give us 15 hours," Chevy explained. "That's a long time. I'd rather be safe." "How far away is the settlement?" "I'm not sure." He pointed to the house. "The farmer there said 4 hours.
"Does he know the Indians?"
"No, he doesn't like Indians. Says he never sees them on the river."
Chevy packed a small tent, 2 blankets, 2 mosquito nets, a rain fly for the tent, 2 buckets to dip out rainfall, and his poncho. Well, he added a box of food and a case of bottled water. Seated on his bunk in the cabin, Nate took the copy of the will, the acknowledgment, and the waiver from his briefcase, folded them together, and placed them in a letter-sized envelope. An official Stafford law firm envelope. Since there were no Ziploc bags or garbage liners on board, he wrapped the envelope in a 12-inch square section he cut from the hem of his poncho. He taped the seams with duct tape, and after examining his handiwork, declared his package to be waterproof. Then he taped it to his T-shirt across his chest and covered it with a light denim pullover. There were copies of the papers in his briefcase, which he would leave behind. And since the Santa Laura seemed much more secure than the John boat, he decided to leave the sat phone, too. He double-checked the papers and the phone, then locked the briefcase and left it on his bunk. "Today could be the day," he thought to himself. There was a nervous excitement in finally meeting Rachel Lane. Breakfast was a quick roll with butter on the deck, standing above the John boat and watching the clouds. 4 hours meant 6 or 8 in Brazil, and Nate was anxious to cast off. The last item Chevy loaded into the boat was a clean, shiny machete with a long handle.
"This is for the anacondas," he said, laughing. Nate tried to ignore it.
He waved goodbye to Welly, then huddled over his last cup of coffee as they floated with the river until Chevy started the outboard. Mist settled just above the water, and it was cool. Since leaving Corumbá, Nate had observed the river from the safety of the top deck. Now he was practically sitting on it. He glanced around and saw no life jackets. The river slapped the hull. Nate kept a wary eye on the mist, watching for debris, a nice fat tree trunk with a jagged end, and the John boat was history. They went cross-current until they entered the mouth of the tributary that would take them to the Indians. The water there was much calmer. The outboard whined and left a boiling wake. The Paraguay disappeared quickly. On Chevy's river map, the tributary was officially labeled as the Cabixá. Chevy had never navigated it before because there had been no need. It coiled like string out of Brazil and into Bolivia, and apparently went nowhere. At its mouth, it was 80 feet wide at most, and narrowed to about 50 as they followed it. It had flooded in some places. In others, the brush along the banks was thicker than the Paraguay. 15 minutes in, Nate checked his watch. He would time everything. Jevy slowed the boat as they approached the first fork, the first of 1,000. A river of the same size branched to the left, and the captain was faced with the decision of which route would keep them on the Cabichá. They kept to the right, but somewhat slower, and soon entered a lake. Jevy stopped the motor. "Hold on," he said, and stood on the gas tanks, gazing at the floodwaters that encircled them. The boat was perfectly still. A ragged row of scrub trees caught his attention. He pointed and said something to himself. Exactly how much guesswork was involved, Nate couldn't tell. Jevy had studied his maps and had lived on these rivers. They all led back to the Paraguay. If they took a wrong turn and got lost, surely the currents would eventually lead them back to Welly. They followed the scrub trees and flooded thickets that in the dry season made up the riverbank, and soon they were in the middle of a shallow stream with limbs overhead. It didn't look like the Cabichá, but a quick glance at the captain's face revealed nothing but confidence. An hour into the journey, they approached the first dwelling, a mud-splattered little hut with a red-tiled roof. 3 feet of water covered the bottom of it, and there was no sign of humans or animals. Jevy slowed so they could talk.
"In the flood season, many people in the Pantanal move to higher ground. They load up their cows and kids and leave for 3 months."
"I haven't seen higher ground."
"There's not much of it. But every Pantaneiro has a place to go this time of the year."
"What about the Indians?"
"They move around, too."
"Wonderful. We don't know where they are, and they like to move around." Jevy chuckled and said,
"We'll find them."
They floated by the hut. It had no doors or windows. Not much to come home to. 90 minutes. And Nate had completely forgotten about being eaten when they rounded a bend and came close to a pack of alligators sleeping in a pile in 6 inches of water. The boat startled them and upset their nap. Tails slapped and water splashed. Nate glanced at the machete just in case, then laughed at his own foolishness. The reptiles did not attack. They watched the boat ease past. No animals for the next 20 minutes. The river narrowed again. The banks squeezed together so close that trees from both sides touched each other above the water. It was suddenly dark. They were floating through a tunnel. Nate checked his watch. The Santa Laura was 2 hours away. As they zigzagged through the marshes, they caught glimpses of the horizon. The mountains of Bolivia were looming, getting closer, it seemed. The water widened, the trees cleared, and they entered a large lake with more than a dozen little rivers twisting into it. They circled slowly the first time, then even slower the second. All the tributaries looked the same. The Cabichá was one of a dozen, and the captain had not a clue. Jevy stood on the gas tanks and surveyed the flood while Nate sat motionless. A fisherman was in the weeds on the other side of the lake. Finding him would be their only luck of the day. He was sitting patiently in a small handmade canoe, one carved from a tree a very long time ago. He wore a ragged straw hat that hid most of his face. When they were only a few feet away, close enough to inspect him, Nate noticed that he was fishing without the benefit of a pole or a rod. No stick of any sort. The line was wrapped around his hand. Jevy said all the right things in Portuguese and handed him a bottle of water. Nate just smiled and listened to the soft, slurring sounds of the strange language. It was slower than Spanish, almost as nasal as French. If the fisherman was happy to see another human in the middle of nowhere, he certainly didn't show it. Where could the poor man live? Then they started pointing, in the general direction of the mountains, though by the time they finished, the little man had encompassed the entire lake with his bearings. They chatted some more, and Nate got the impression Jevy was extracting every scrap of information. It could be hours before they saw another face. With the swamps and rivers swollen, navigation was proving difficult. 2.5 hours in, and they were already lost. A cloud of small black mosquitoes swept over them, and Nate scrambled for the repellent. The fishermen watched him with curiosity. They said goodbye and paddled away, drifting with the slight wind.
"His mother was an Indian," Chevy said.
"That's nice," Nate replied, hammering mosquitoes.
"There's a settlement a few hours from here."
"A few hours?"
"3, maybe."
They had 15 hours of fuel, and Nate planned to count every minute of it. The Kabisha began again near an inlet where another very identical river also left the lake. It widened, and they were off, at full throttle. Nate moved lower in the boat, and found a spot on the bottom between the box of food and the bucket, with his back to the bench. From there the mist couldn't spray his head. He was contemplating a nap when the motor sputtered. The boat lurched and slowed. He kept his eyes on the river, afraid to turn around and look at Chevy. Engine trouble was not something he had spent time worrying about yet. Their journey had enough little perils already. It would take days of back-breaking labor to paddle back to Welly. They would be forced to sleep in the boat, eat what they'd brought until the food ran out, dip water from it during the rains, and hope like hell they could find their little fishing buddy to point them to safety. Suddenly, Nate was terrified. Then they were off again, the motor howling as if nothing had happened. It became a routine. Every 20 minutes or so, just as Nate was about to doze off, the steady strain of the motor would break. The bow would dip. Nate would quickly look at the edges of the river to inspect the wildlife. Chevy would curse in Portuguese, fiddle with the choke and the throttle, and then things would be fine for another 20 minutes or so. They had lunch, cheese, saltines, and cookies, under a tree in a small fork as rain fell around them.
"That little fisherman back there," Nate said. "Does he know the Indians?"
"Yes. About once a month they go to the Paraguay to trade with a boat. He sees them."
"Did you ask him if he'd ever seen a female missionary?"
"I did. He has not. You're the first American he's ever seen."
"Lucky guy."
The first sign of the settlement came at almost 7 hours. Nate saw a thin line of blue smoke rising above the trees near the foot of a hill. Chevy was certain they were in Bolivia. The ground was higher, and they were close to the mountains. The flooded areas were behind them. They came to a gap in the